From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
What we've been told is that we're very, very close. Any differences are very minor, and the push that they have, they're always pushing to spend more, but their recommendations on spending more in certain human services or MAP grants, I'm a MAP grant advocate, that we're very close, and that could get finalized.
The legislation we're talking about today is just one step. It adds suspected terrorists to the list of persons who should be legally prohibited from purchasing firearms in Illinois. It requires the state police to report to local law enforcement those who are suspected of terrorism, along with those who are mentally ill, those convicted of domestic abuse.
But this bill takes away guns that shouldn't, from people that shouldn't have them, and it gives due process. And that's exactly what we're trying to do. That's what's been missing at the national level. Ultimately, you know, as law-abiding gun owner, I like this legislation. I think it's going to save lives.
That's Republican State Representative Ed Sullivan of Mundelein. Before that, we heard from Democrat Greg Harris of Chicago, another state rep, talking about bipartisan gun legislation that has surfaced in the wake of the shooting deaths of 49 people in Orlando, Florida. Well, Governor Bruce Rauner says his Republican negotiators and Democrats are getting closer to an agreement on a partial state budget. We'll be talking about those topics and more on today's State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler. He runs the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also in our Statehouse Bureau, we have Amanda Vinicky, the Statehouse Bureau Chief for Illinois Public Radio. And also with us today, Brian Mackey, IPR reporter, and Jamie Dunn, Illinois Issues Editor. Well, Amanda, let me start with you. We're nearing the end of the one fiscal year. We're getting ready to start another. And lawmakers now apparently coming back into session on Wednesday of next week. They could take up that so-called stopgap spending plan. Do we know what that would entail?
We don't know if they will for sure take that up or what is going to happen. You have had, since session recessed at the end of May, which is the typical deadline for passing a budget because thereafter it takes extra votes to pass anything and have it take effect right away, you have had this bipartisan working group, basically the budgeteers, the head of appropriations committees, and that's from both the House and the Senate, Republicans and Democrats alike, with Tim Nuding, that's the governor's budget director, meeting. Sometimes once a week, generally more, maybe even in talks every day to try and work up a stopgap plan that is largely based on the one that you had Republicans introducing that very last day of session on May 31st. They've now finished that work. And when you speak with members, they say, you know, they're done. And it is, as I noted, based on what the Republicans had introduced, but there are some differences that include what Democrats had wanted, and that includes more money for certain human services, because as you may recall, there is a measure that would get some money flowing to social service agencies that has been on Governor Bruce Rauner's desk. He hasn't acted on it. That's a whole other fight. This would be another route of getting money to some of those agencies. Also, extra money for universities and for MAP grants. And yet there are some pretty big gaping holes in this stopgap plan, and that has to be worked out amongst Governor Rauner and the leaders. So when you look to that end, what is still left is some more social services spending. In short, that appears to be money for teen reach, autism programs, after school programs that had never previously been included in the governor's ideas of what to fund and come up with, as he's really been focused on state operations. And then education funding, which has been a key throughout this whole budget fight. If you remember the two plans, one passed by the House, one passed by the Senate, but both with only Democratic support, that moved forward at the end of May and then stalled when they got to the opposite chamber. Both of those gave hundreds of millions of dollars more to schools than what was part of the Republican and the governor's version. And that still needs to be worked out. And we're expecting that it'll be the crux of any sort of talks among the legislative leaders and Rauner.
Jamie Dunn, they were supposed to be in session every week. We heard that from the House Speaker at the end of May, that they would be coming back to work on this stuff. They've not been in session. They've been meeting, though. These bipartisan groups have been meeting. They've kept everything pretty close to the vest. it seems to me that if not all the lawmakers out there understand it and, you know, have agreed to it in advance, it's going to be hard to pass this in one day, but that could happen, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they've definitely gotten budget plans together that quickly. And if, you know, a lot of the, as Amanda said, kind of rough outlines of this stuff are finished and out there, it's very possible that we could see action if, like Amanda just said, it kind of comes down to the leadership at this point, if they can work out what one of the big points of contention of this has been all along is money for Chicago Public Schools.
And how much money are we – do we have any idea what we're talking about? I mean, is it, you know, $100 million that could be the difference here? Or is it going to be a lot more than that? Do we have any idea?
I don't think we really have any idea, but where we believe that this is a big – issue is that Governor Rauner has been making the rounds with one-on-ones with reporters, speaking to editorial boards. And when he was before the Crane's Chicago Business and talked about how close a stopgap budget was to reaching a deal, he nonetheless said, I'm not going to do anything that's a, quote, CPS bailout. You've had the spokesman for the House Speaker say, nobody's talking about a bailout. But that's really a big difference of what Rauner considers a bailout is what Democrats, particularly those from Chicago, consider just basic funding of their schools. And it gets back to the idea of the state pays for the pensions of every other district, but not for CPS. CPS is in a world of hurt and needing to come through with cash that helps it, as well as other struggling districts that are, you know, we talk about this disparity in terms of how the state sends money to districts and those that have low property, those that are in poorer areas aren't getting what they need. And so we don't know, per se, what is going to be settled for this, and if it will all be settled. I mean, when we talk stopgap, the idea is to get a six-month budget. And again, really the focus is Governor Rauner wants something that can keep operations going at this time where we've been hearing about prisons, for example, and a community taking a vote on whether they were going to no longer allow water to flow to a prison because the state's so behind on its bills. Really, time running out for that. So the governor has been focused on operations, the Democrats more focused on human services, and then there is this education fight. And it truly is a very big difference of opinion. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, the trust factor that has been an issue this whole time as well.
Let me go out on a limb and say, Charlie Wheeler, you're not a fan of a stopgap budget?
It would be better if we just did a regular budget, but under these circumstances, a stopgap budget is better than the autopilot that we've been on for close to a year. And
why is that, Charlie? I mean, a lot of people are getting paid, so why is it better to have something like that in place, at least temporarily?
Well, because as I understand it, this so-called stopgap budget would include funding for some human service providers that has not been included in the autopilot. The autopilot, as it's been referred to, basically refers to state spending that has to occur either because the law says it doesn't matter if there's an appropriation or not, we have to pay the people who buy our bonds. The law also says it doesn't matter whether the legislature appropriates a nickel, we have to make the payments into the state retirement systems. Then there are court decrees where over time the state has agreed with plaintiffs that, yeah, we're not really doing what we ought to, and we promise that we will in the future. And so the federal judge says, okay, here's this agreement. You've agreed to it, and this money goes forward. And then there's the decision by the St. Clair County Circuit Judge that state employees get paid regardless of whether there's an appropriation or not. So all this stuff is flowing out. But there are any number of human service providers who had contracts with the state, who in good faith have been caring for vulnerable people who haven't been paid. And some of them are closing, most of them have reduced services dramatically. And until you have a full budget, they can't be protected. But with a stopgap budget, they will be included in there and they'll at least get something to allow them to keep the doors open while we wait for fiscal responsibility to set in on the governor and the legislature.
Yeah, of course.
So better than nothing, but not ideal.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I think that there are people who say, like State Representative Scott Drury sent a note to his constituents. He's a Democrat from, I believe, Highland Park in the House, saying that, you know, this just postpones fiscal responsibility or fiscal reality from setting in. The governor is saying, well, the Democrats have said they won't vote on any of my agenda until after the election. And frankly, I find it hard to believe that after the election, which, at worst, as Charlie has pointed out, the Senate Democrats might lose their supermajority, but they're already guaranteed pretty much because of the number of people up for re-election to maintain a majority in the Senate. And it would be very hard for Speaker Madigan to lose control of the House. A lot of people are saying, well, given Trump at the top of the ticket, it could just end up being a push. We could see very few seats changing hands this fall. So then the Democrats are suddenly going to be willing to embrace the more controversial anti-union aspects of the governor's agenda at that point. And I think that what people like Representative Drury are saying is that we're just postponing this ultimate reckoning, which is the governor's agenda on workers' compensation, on reducing collective bargaining rights for government unions in local government, police officers, firefighters, trash haulers, that sort of thing. Is that worth not funding state government the way we've done for, 190-some-odd years
since
here.
Since 1818.
Here in Illinois.
And Brian, I think that brings up another point. I mean, I've heard some people talk about, the possibility, well, we're pushing this off for another 6 months. That's one thing. But then I've also heard people saying this may set the precedent, at least for the rest of Governor Rauner's term, that we may be looking at best case scenario as these temporary patchwork budgets just to keep going because they can't agree on something larger. So that also, that also leads to some bigger concerns down the road.
Yeah, and I think the folks in social services have mixed feelings in that concern because, we're seeing news stories every day about a different social service program being cut back. We're seeing the United Way doing polling, finding out that they estimate about 1 million clients have lost services based on the survey of just the folks that they help fund. And they, only about a quarter of those people responded. So it's a much higher number than that. That's conservative. They need the money now, but they're also afraid if a stopgap happens, what happens to the long-term plan? When will they have stability?
And what happens, Jamie, if they pass this? I mean, there may be people thinking, well, they're going to get right back to work and keep looking at trying to put a full-year budget together starting maybe the second week of July. But with elections coming up, parades to walk in throughout the summer, all the things that people do during the election season and during the summer months, is it likely that it just goes off the table for, the rest of the summer, maybe into the fall, maybe even beyond that, before we get really back to trying to even push together some type of deal?
I think that's possible. I mean, we do have these working groups that are looking at these turnaround agenda items. And we have seen, for instance, when they were working on, pension reform that ultimately passed but was tossed out by the court, that there were small groups of lawmakers that kind of kept working year round, kept on it. So we may see that happen, but folks are going to be really distracted by the election. And so even if there is a core group that are working on these things, I wouldn't expect to see the legislature come back and do anything with them.
And to me, the difficulty with trying to do stopgap budgets from now until we have a new governor, either Governor Rauner for a second term, he said he wants to run again, or someone else who the Democrats might nominate. The difficulty is sooner or later we have to address the revenue situation. I mean, there's two elements here. One is the appropriation. All the appropriation says is that this particular agency can spend this particular amount of dollars for this particular purpose from this particular fund. It doesn't create any new dollars. And so under this autopilot notion, we're spending at fiscal year 2015 levels, when for half a year we had higher income tax rates. And so we're spending at roughly a $36, $37 billion clip when we're only going to bring in about $32 billion from our general fund. And so this imbalance can't continue forever because as an agency director, I may be able to send a voucher over to the comptroller and say, pay this bill. And comptroller Leslie Munger says, there's no money. And so that's why the bill backlog is in the neighborhood of $8 billion because we don't have the dollars. And I don't see how we could possibly continue for another couple of years with these stopgap budgets without addressing the revenue situation. Because much as people don't like tax increases, my guess is that lawmakers are just as unwilling, as was the governor in the unbalanced budget he proposed, to make the kind of deep cuts in core state services that you would need to balance it only by slashing programs.
The governor did somewhat address this notion of how long can the state go on, and he said, no, it won't be for the 4 years of my term. Not sure how much that is up to him, I guess, because obviously you'll need Democratic input there, and we did have in May one of the speaker's big foremost leaders, Representative Liu Lang, talk about this notion of maybe this will be something. Maybe the stalemate is so deep that it will. We have to fathom not having a complete or comprehensive budget for the remainder of the Rauner administration. He said it's not something he's hoping for per se, but that it is a possible reality. Because what I think cannot be understated at this point, and in a sense, it sounds perhaps juvenile or like it is taking away from the politics, the very real policy matters that are at heart here, is, as I noted earlier, the distrust in between particularly the governor and Speaker Madigan. It is, of course, more than just two men and their personalities. But when you speak with insiders, people who've been in on these meetings, there is the potential for coming to a compromise, even on aspects of the turnaround agenda. It just appears that at any one time or another, there is not, however, an agreement at the top between the Democratic supermajority leaders and the governor's office. And at one hand, it may be the governor who says no. On the other, it may be one of the Democratic leaders. But really, it seems to be at this point that when we talk about the possibility of a stopgap, will one or the other pull the rug out from under it?
And I think that's a great point, Amanda, about the distrust. And I think that when people talk about, well, there's just a personality conflict between the governor and the House Speaker or Senate President, for example, I think that that you say there's just distrust and enmity between those men. That kind of misses the point of what's happening here. Governor Rauner's—
It's deeper.
Mm-hmm. One of his main purposes in office is, I mean, there's really two that I can discern from what he's emphasized. One is weakening government employee unions, if not, you know, eliminating their ability to bargain for their members. The other is weakening, if not removing from power, House Speaker Michael Madigan. Now, you know, and that's why he talks about his term limits proposal. Now, of course, that wouldn't take effect for practically another decade almost. And so the speaker would be well into his 80s by that point. Who knows what the future holds if he'll decide to stay in office that long or what would happen. But, I mean, this is, you know, a part of the push to weaken unions is also a push to weaken a key fundraising source for the Democratic Party. I mean, we've seen that nationally. That's something that's played out in many other states, certainly just in Wisconsin in the past few years. And so I think when you think that this fight is not about, well, what should there be a causation standard in workers' compensation, and, you know, should trial lawyers have to, you know, file a certain type of motion to move their cases? Where do they get to file their cases? I mean, this is those kind of details can be worked out. But if you step back and realize that the governor thinks the speaker is the root of much of what has gone wrong in Illinois government over the past several decades, and, you know, views labor unions as anathema to fiscal prudence in his view, then it's hard to see how you can compromise and negotiate on those things. I mean, I don't think the House Speaker is going to offer to quit as a compromise, which I'm sure would satisfy the governor quite a great deal.
Well, that doesn't seem, Brand, to make me feel as though that even if they pass something to get them through for 6 months, that anything's going to change in 6 months from now. So, you know,
I've been very struck that the governor and Senate Minority Leader Christine Rodonia have been saying, well, the Democrats say they're not going to, they want to wait until after the election to do these reforms, quote unquote reforms. But I have not heard, and you know, I don't know, except when the governor says what people tell him in private, I don't know what's going on behind closed doors in these negotiating sessions, but I just can't imagine the Democrats are suddenly going to flip on these things that they have staked so much and caused so much pain among some of their key constituencies, i.e., people who rely on social service providers. You know, there are Republicans who care about these things too, but people have so much riding on this, and they've invested so much time and effort behind their positions now. It just makes it harder and harder the longer we go on.
And Charlie, I'll give you the last word on this one before we move on.
Well, everybody talks about we have to get past the November election. And I understand kind of the psychology that's involved. It's kind of what we've always thought. But if you look at the hard numbers right now, there are 48 people in the Illinois Senate who don't have opposition in November if they're running again. Some of them are in the middle of four-year terms, so they're not even on the ballot. There's a couple who are retiring. In the House, that's 74. So that's more than the extraordinary majorities that you would need. So nobody's is going to be put out on a limb. And if the leaders actually come to an agreement and we do raise taxes, there will be Republicans on that. There will be Democrats voting for that bill. And I suspect that all the leadership, the Senate Republican leader Christine Rodonio, House Republican leader Jim Durkin, Speaker Madigan, Senate President John Cullerton, they'll all be voting aye for that tax increase. And so its ability to be used as some kind of a campaign device is going to be undercut by the fact if I'm running as an incumbent Democrat and I voted for the tax increase, my opponent can't say, oh, you voted for the tax increase, because I can respond, well, so did your leader.
Amanda, I want to save some time here to talk about a piece of legislation that was introduced this week. It comes in the wake of that shooting massacre that took place in Orlando, Florida. You covered this. It's gun legislation in the state. Give us the quick rundown of what this would do.
Well, we've gotten a lot of attention, obviously, on what has gone in Washington, D.C. in legislation that is based on the terror watch list. This is not that. Rather, it is a measure, as you noted, Sean, bipartisan. So it is been cooked up by Representative Greg Harris. He's a Chicago Democrat, but also has been signed on to by some key Republican leaders, Ed Sullivan, who we heard from at the top of the program, as well as House GOP leader Jim Durkin. And basically, the aim is also centered on those who have a connection with terror. And it would say that if there is anybody who presents a, quote, clear and present danger, at least somebody who is either maybe a school counselor or a therapist or law enforcement feels that way, they would not be able to get their hands on a firearm. It could revoke their firearm owner's identification card. And likewise, if there is an individual that has been charged with a terror crime, not yet convicted, but charged, it would take, again, revoke their gun rights is really at the heart of this. It also includes some police training.
Jamie Dunn, let me ask you, because I have a lot of friends who are anti-gun, and I have a lot of friends who own guns and are big gun supporters, gun rights supporters. Certainly the people who want to see more restrictive laws on guns, I can understand that they would back this idea. Why should those people who want to keep their guns and feel as though maybe a lot of times that certain laws are proposed that put them under threat, why should they back this?
Well, I think, it has the Rifles Association's backing. And I think the reason why is that it doesn't go as far as some of the federal proposals have. As Amanda said, you would have to actually be charged with something, which is similar to what we look at with domestic violence now. If you're charged and there's a restraining order against you, you can lose your gun or guns. But when the terror watch list comes into play here, it's more about reporting. It's more about the state police being able to report to the FBI that, hey, we've got this person that we may have some concerns about, but it's not an automatic, you can't have a gun. You know, there's been worry at the federal level about using the terror watch list to determine whether someone can have a gun or not because people have ended up on it accidentally. It's difficult to always find out why you're on it or how you might be able to get off of it. And so there is some concern that people would lose their Second Amendment rights because of a clerical error. But this bill would not go that far or kind of touch that, controversial component of what the federal proposals have.
And as a matter of fact, the head of the State Rifle Association, Richard Pearson, was quoted as saying that this is not overly intrusive into gun owners' rights. And so if it has the backing of the State Rifle Association, I would assume most gun owners would rely on the association to give them a accurate perspective of what any pending legislation might have on their Second Amendment rights.
Well, yeah, and if you've watched gun legislation move in Illinois, it's tough to get that sign off from that organization. And this stuff is always sort of negotiated like crazy if it's going to be able to pass. So coming out with something that has bipartisan support from the get-go, is you just really never see that happen here. So it is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, and I would just add that State Representative Ed Sullivan, I think, probably has credibility on this issue, I would imagine, among some of your gun owner friends, Sean, mm-hmm. because he is the—
I have friends on both sides.
Yeah, sure. But he is
oh,
the—
Oh, we all do.
Yeah, I think everyone does.
Right. It's hard not to live in downstate Illinois and not know people who go both ways on that issue. But State Representative Ed Sullivan was a key sponsor and negotiator on the concealed carry legislation that passed a couple of years ago.
And Jamie, do you think this is going to come up for a vote this next week? Have we heard if it's going to be called for a vote? Or
you know, I'm not certain on that. Amanda might have a better idea, but I'm guessing it's something to watch for anytime they're going to be around.
Especially if you have, to be perfectly frank about it, if you have legislators not ready to vote on a stopgap budget, this could be something that gives them action to move forward on when they are back in Springfield.
Okay. Well, let's move along to our notes from the field. Brian Mackey, let me start with you.
Yeah, more budget fallout, a little less dire than some of the other ones, unless you're the one paying the fee. We've learned this week that the Secretary of State's office has collected double the amount of late fees this year. This stems back to a decision last fall saying the office could not afford the $450,000 a month in monthly postage costs to send people their license plate reminders. And so instead, people have just been not noticing that their plates expired. When they go to renew, they end up having to pay a late fee. The state collected nearly $10 million in late fees so far this year. That's more than, or about double the amount they collected last year. So the lesson here is go out when you're walking to your car next time and write down that that date in your calendar when you need to renew.
Somebody is making money during the budget impasse, at least. Charlie Wheeler.
Well, on a more somber note, this past week, former House Speaker Denny Hastert reported to a federal prison in Rochester, Minnesota, to begin serving his term for lying to the FBI out of incidents involving his sexual abuse of young men when he was a wrestling coach and teacher at Yorkville High School many, many years ago.
Jamie Dunn.
So another kind of fallout here, if we don't see some sort of budget resolution next week before the fiscal year starts, IDOT has announced that they will be shutting down road construction projects starting on June 30th. So we're going to see potentially a lot of that summer road construction being halted.
And Amanda Vinicky.
Well, the Democratic National Convention isn't for another month or so yet, but you do have the platform committee meeting in our Midwestern area. Will be in St. Louis this weekend to do its formal review and deliberations of the party platform. There will be an Illinoisan that is in on that. You have Congressman from Illinois, Luis Gutierrez, as part of the committee.
All right, that will do it for today's State Week. Members of our broadcast include Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Vinicky, Brian Mackey, and Jamie Dunn. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. Just look for State Week. The production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.